Chapter 8 Dragon's Eggs. Luca had the show folk breaking camp, taking down the big canvas wall and packing everything into the wagons while the sky was still dark the next morning. It was the clatter and banging of it, the shouting, that woke Matt, groggy and stiff from sleeping on the floor. As much as he could sleep, for the bloody dice. Those things gave a man dreams that slaughtered sleep. Luca was rushing about in his shirt sleeves with a lantern, giving orders and likely impeding matters as much as speeding them, but Petra, wide enough to seem squat, though he was not all that much shorter than Matt, paused in hitching the four-horse team to his and Clarine's wagon to explain. With the waning moon low on the horizon and half hidden by trees, a lantern on the driver's seat gave all the light they had, a flickering pool of yellow that was repeated 100 times and more through the camp. Clarine was off walking the dogs, since they would be spending most of the day inside the wagon.
"Yesterday," the strong man shook his head and patted the nearest animal, patiently waiting for the last straps to be buckled, as if the horse had showed signs of nerves. Maybe he felt edgy himself. The night was only cool, not really cold, yet he was bundled up in a dark coat and had on a knitted cap. His wife worried about him falling sick from drafts or the cold, and took care that he would not.
"Well, we're strangers everywhere, you see, and a lot of people think they can take advantage of strangers. But if we let one man get away with it, 10 more will try, if not 100. Sometimes the local magistrate or what passes for one will uphold the law for us too, but only sometimes. Because we're strangers, and tomorrow or the next day we'll be gone, and anyway everybody knows strangers are usually up to no good. So we have to stand up for ourselves, fight for what's ours, if need be. Once you do that, though, it's time to move along. Same now as when there were only a few dozen of us with Luca, counting the horse handlers, though in those days we'd have been gone as soon as those soldiers left. In those days there weren't so many coins to be lost by leaving in a hurry," he said dryly, and shook his head, perhaps for Luca's greed or perhaps for how large the show had grown, before going on. "Those 3 Seanchan have friends, or at least companions who won't like their own being faced down. That standard-bearer did it, but you can be sure they'll lay it to us, because they think they can hit at us, and they can't at her. Maybe their officers will uphold the law, or their rules, or whatever, like she did, but we can't be sure of that. What is certain, though, is that those fellows will cause trouble if we stay another day. No point to staying when it means fights with soldiers, and maybe people hurt so they can't perform, and sure trouble with the law one way or another."
It was the longest speech Matt had ever heard from Petra, and the man cleared his throat as though embarrassed by saying so much.
"Well," he muttered, bending back to the harness, "Luca will want to be on the road soon. You want to be seeing to your own horses."
Matt wanted no such thing. The most wonderful thing about having coin was not what you could buy, but that you could pay others to do the work. As soon as he realized the show was preparing to move, he had rousted the 4 Red Arms from the tent they shared with Chell Bannon to hitch the teams for his wagon and 2 Ons, do as he instructed with the razor, and saddle Pips. The stout horse thief, he had not stolen a horse since Matt had known him, but that was what he was, had roused himself long enough to say that he would get up when the others returned, then rolled over in his blankets and was snoring again before Harnan and the others had their boots half on. Bannon's skills were such that no one voiced any complaint beyond the usual grumbling about the hour, and all but Harnan would have grumbled if allowed to sleep till noon. When those skills were needed, he would repay them 10-fold, and they knew it, even Fergin. The skinny red arm was none too bright except when it came to soldiering, but he was plenty smart enough there. Well, smart enough. The show left Jurador before the sun broke the horizon, a long snake of wagons rolling along the wide road through the darkness with Luca's lurid monstrosity pulled by 6 horses at its head. Tuon's wagon came just behind, with Gordaren driving, almost wide-shouldered enough to seem a strong man himself, and Tuon and Seleucia, well cloaked and hooded, squeezed in on either side of him. The storage wagons and animal cages and spare horses brought up the tail. Sentries at the Seanchan camp watched them depart, silent armored figures in the night marching the camp's perimeter. Not that the camp itself was quiet.
Shadowy forms stood in rigid lines among the tents while loud voices bellowed the roll call at a steady pace and others answered. Matt all but held his breath until those regular shouts faded away behind him. Discipline was a wonderful thing. For other men, anyway. He rode Pips alongside the Aes Sedai wagon, near the middle of the long line, flinching a little every time the foxhead went cool against his chest, which it began to do before they had gone much more than a mile. It seemed that Jolene was wasting no time. Fergan, handling the reins, chattered away about horses and women with Metwin. Both were as happy as pigs in clover, but then neither had any idea what was going on inside the wagon. At least the medallion only turned cool, and barely that. They were using small amounts of the power. Still, he disliked being so near any channeling at all. In his experience, Aes Sedai carried trouble in their belt pouches, and seldom were shy about scattering it, never mind who might be in the way. No, with the dice bouncing inside his head, he could have done without Aes Sedai within 10 miles. He would have ridden up beside Tuon for the chance to talk with her, no matter that Seleucia and Gordoran would hear every word, but you never wanted a woman thinking you were too eager. Do that, and she either took advantage or else skittered away like a water drop on a hot greased griddle. Tuon found enough ways to take advantage already, and he had too little time for very much in the way of chasing. Sooner or later she would speak the words that completed the marriage ceremony, sure as water was wet. But that only made it more urgent for him to find out what she was like, which had hardly been easy so far. That little woman made a blacksmith's puzzle seem simple. But how could a man be married to a woman if he did not know her? Worse, he had to make her see him as something more than toy. Marriage to a woman with no respect for him would be like wearing a shirt of black wasp nettles day and night. Worse still, he had to make her care for him, or he would find himself forced to hide from his own wife to keep her from making him Dacovale. And to cap it off, he had to do all of that in whatever time remained before he had to send her back to Abu Dhar. A fine stew, and doubtless a tasty meal for some hero out of legend, a little something to occupy his idle time before he rushed off to perform some great deed. Only Matt Bloody Cawthon was no bloody hero. He still had it to do, though, and no time or room for missteps. It was the earliest start they had made yet, but his hopes that the Seanchan had frightened Luca into moving faster were soon dashed. As the sun climbed, they passed stone farm buildings clinging to hillsides and occasionally a tiny tile or thatch-roofed village, nestled beside the road in a surround of stone-walled fields carved out of the forest, where men and women stood gaping as the show streamed past and children ran alongside until their parents called them back. But in the mid-afternoon, the show reached something larger. Runnion Crossing, near a so-called river that could have been waded in fewer than 20 paces without going more than waist-deep despite the stone bridge across it, was never a patch on Jurador, but it possessed 4 inns, each 3 stories of stone roofed in green or blue tiles, and near 1/2 mile of hard-packed dirt between the village and the river where merchants could park their wagons for the night. Farms with their walled fields and orchards and pastures made a quilt of the countryside for a good league along the road, and maybe more beyond the hills to either side of it. They certainly covered the hillsides Matt could see. That was enough for Luca. Ordering the canvas wall erected in the clearing, near to the river to make watering the animals easier, the man strutted into the village wearing coat and cloak red enough to make Matt's eyes hurt, and so embroidered with golden stars and comets that a tinker would have wept for the shame of donning the garments. The huge blue and red banner was stretched across the entrance, each wagon in its place, the performing platforms unloaded and the wall nearly all up by the time he returned, escorting 3 men and 3 women. The village was not all that far from Abu Dhar, yet their clothing might have come from another country altogether. The men wore short wool coats in bright colors embroidered with angular scrollwork along the shoulders and sleeves, and dark baggy trousers stuffed into knee boots. The women, their hair in a sort of coiled bun atop their heads, wore dresses nearly as colorful as Luca's garments, their narrow skirts resplendent with flowers from hem to hips. They did all carry long belt knives, though with straight blades for the most part, and caressed the hilts whenever anybody looked at them. That much was the same. Altara was Altara when it came to touchiness. These were the village mayor, the 4 innkeepers, and a lean, leathery, white-haired woman in red. The others addressed her respectfully as mother. Since the round-bellied mare was as white-haired as she, not to mention mostly bald, and none of the innkeepers lacked at least a little gray hair, Matt decided she must be the village wisdom. He smiled and tipped his hat to her as she passed, and she gave him a sharp look and sniffed in near-perfect imitation of Nynaeve. Oh, yes, a wisdom, all right. Luca showed them around with wide smiles and expansive gestures, elaborate bows and flourishes of his cloak, stopping here and there to make a juggler or a team of acrobats perform a little for his guests, but his smile turned to a sour grimace once they were safely back on their way and out of sight.
"Free admission for them, and their husbands and wives, and all the children," he growled to Matt. "And I'm supposed to pack up if a merchant comes down the road." They weren't that blunt, but they were clear enough, especially that Mother Darvale, as if this fly speck ever attracted enough merchants to fill this field.
"Thieves and scoundrels, Cotton. Country folk are all thieves and scoundrels, and an honest man like me is at their mercy."
Soon enough he was totting up what he might earn there despite the complimentary admissions, but he never did give over complaining entirely, even when the line at the entrance stretched nearly as far as it had in Jurador. He just added complaining about how much he would have taken in with another 3 or 4 days at the Salt Town. It was 3 or 4 days now, and likely he would have lingered until the crowds had dwindled to nothing. Maybe those 3 Seanchen had been Taviran work. Not likely, but it was a pleasant way to think of it. Now that it was all in the past, it was. That was how they progressed. At best a mere 2 leagues, or perhaps 3, at an unhurried pace, and usually Luca would find a small town or a cluster of villages that he felt called for a halt. Or better to say that he felt their silver calling to him. Even if they passed nothing but fly specks not worth the labor of erecting the wall, they never made as much as 4 leagues before Luca called a halt. He was not about to risk having to camp strung out along the road. If there was not to be a show, Luca liked to find a clearing where the wagons could be parked without too much crowding, though if driven to it, he would dicker with a farmer for the right to stop in an unused pasture, and mutter over the expense the whole next day if it cost no more than a silver penny. He was tight with his purse strings, Luca was. Trains of merchants' wagons passed them in both directions, making good speed and managing to raise small clouds of dust from the hard-packed road. Merchants wanted to get their goods to market as quickly as possible. Now and then they saw a caravan of tinkers, too, their boxy wagons as bright as anything in the show except for Luca's wagon. All of them were headed toward Ebu Dar, oddly enough, but then they moved as slowly as Luca. Not likely any coming the other way would overtake the show. 2 or 3 leagues a day, and the dice rattled away so that Matt was always wondering what lay beyond the next bend in the road, or what was catching him up from behind. It was enough to give a man hives. The very first night, outside Runyon Crossing, he approached Aludra. Near her bright blue wagon, she had set up a small canvas enclosure 8 feet tall for launching her night flowers, and she straightened with a glare when he pulled back a flap and ducked in. A closed lantern sitting on the ground near the wall gave enough light for him to see that she was holding a dark ball the size of a large melon. Runyon Crossing was only big enough to merit a single night flower. She opened her mouth, all set to chivy him out. Not even Luca was allowed in here. "Lofting tubes," he said quickly, gesturing to the metal-bound wooden tube, as tall as he was and near enough a foot across, sitting upright in front of her on a broad wooden base. "That's why you want a bell-founder, to make lofting tubes from bronze. It's the why I can't puzzle out." It seemed a ridiculous idea. With a little effort, 2 men could lift one of her lofting tubes into the wagon that carried them and her other supplies. A bronze lofting tube would require a derrick. But it was the only thing that had occurred to him. With the lantern behind her, shadows hid her expression, but she was silent for a long moment. "Such a clever young man," she said finally. Her beaded braids clicked softly as she shook her head. Her laugh was low and throaty.
"Me? I should watch my tongue. I always get into the trouble when I make promises to clever young men. Never think I will tell you the secrets that would make you blush, though, not now. You are already juggling 2 women, it seems, and me, I will not be juggled."
"Then I'm right?" He was barely able to keep the incredulity from his voice.
"You are," she said,
and casually tossed the night flower at him. He caught it with a startled oath and only dared to breathe when he was sure he had a good grip. The covering seemed to be stiff leather, with a tiny stub of fuse sticking out of one side. He had a little familiarity with smaller fireworks, and supposedly those only exploded from fire, or if you let air touch what was inside. Though he had cut one open once without it going off, yet who could say what might make a night flower erupt? The firework he had opened had been small enough to hold in one hand. Something the size of this night flower would likely blow him and Eludra to scraps. Abruptly, he felt foolish. She was not very likely to go throwing the thing if dropping it was dangerous. He began tossing the ball from hand to hand. Not to make up for gasping and all that, just for something to do. How will casting lofting tubes from bronze make them a better weapon? That was what she wanted, weapons to use against the Seanchan to repay them for destroying the Guild of Illuminators. They seem fearsome enough to me already. Eludra snatched the night flower back, muttering about clumsy oafs and turning the ball over in her hands to examine the leather surface. Maybe it was not so safe as he had assumed.
A proper lofting tube, she said, once she was sure he had not damaged the thing. It will send this close to 300 paces straight up into the sky with the right charge, and a longer distance across the ground if the tube is tilted at an angle. But not far enough for what I have in mind. A lofting charge big enough to send it further would burst the tube. With a bronze tube, I could use a charge that would send something a little smaller close to 2 miles. Making the slow match slower, to let it travel that far is easy enough. Smaller, but heavier, made of iron. And there would be nothing for pretty colors, only the bursting charge.
Matt whistled through his teeth, seeing it in his head, explosions erupting among the enemy before they were near enough to see you clearly. A nasty thing to be receiving. Now that would be as good as having Aes Sedai on your side, or some of those Ashaman. Better. Aes Sedai had to be in danger to use the power as a weapon, and while he had heard rumors about hundreds of Ashaman, rumors grew with every telling. Besides, if Ashaman were anything like Aes Sedai, they would start deciding where they were needed, and then take over the whole fight. He began envisioning how to use Eludra's bronze tubes, and right away he spotted a glaring problem. All your advantage was gone if the enemy came from the wrong direction or got behind you, and if you needed derricks to move these things.
These bronze lofting tubes, dragons, she broke in. Lofting tubes are for making the night flowers bloom, for delighting the eye. I will call them dragons, and the Seanchan will howl when my dragons bite.
Her tone was grim as sharp stone.
These dragons, then, whatever you call them, they'll be heavy and hard to move. Can you mount them on wheels, like a wagon or cart? Would they be too heavy for horses to pull?
She laughed again.
It's good to see you are more than the pretty face.
Climbing a 3-step folding ladder that put her waist nearly level with the top of the lofting tube, she set the night flower into the tube with the fuse down. It slid in a little way and stopped, a dome above the top of the tube.
"Hand me that," she told him, gesturing to a pole as long and thick as a quarterstaff.
When he handed it up to her, she held it upright and used a leather cap on one end to push the night flower deeper. That appeared to take little effort.
"I have already drawn plans for the dragon carts. 4 horses could draw one easily, along with a 2nd cart to hold the eggs. Not night flowers, dragons' eggs. You see, I have thought long and hard about how to use my dragons, not just how to make them."
Pulling the capped rod from the tube, she climbed down and picked up the lantern.
"Come, I must make the sky bloom a little. Then I want my supper and my bed."
Just outside the canvas enclosure stood a wooden rack filled with more peculiar implements, a forked stick, tongs as long as Matt was tall, other things just as odd and all made of wood. Setting the lantern on the ground, she placed the capped pole in the rack and took a square wooden box from a shelf.
"I suppose now you want to learn how to make the secret powders, yes? Well, I did promise. I am the guild now," she added bitterly, removing the box's lid.
It was an odd box, a solid piece of wood drilled with holes, each of which held a thin stick. She plucked out one and replaced the lid.
"I can decide what is secret.
Better than that, I want you to come with me. I know somebody will be happy to pay for making as many of your dragons as you want. He can make every Belfounder from Andor to Tyr stop casting bells and start casting dragons. Avoiding Rand's name did not stop the colors from whirling inside his head and resolving for an instant into Rand, fully clothed, thank the light, talking with Loyal by lamplight in a wood-paneled room. There were other people, but the image focused on Rand and had vanished too quickly for Matt to make out who they were. He was pretty sure that what he saw was what was actually happening right that moment, impossible as that seemed. It would be good to see Loyal again, but burn him, there had to be some way to keep those things out of his head. And if he isn't interested... Again the colors came, but he resisted, and they melted away. I can pay to have hundreds cast myself. A lot of them, anyway. The band was going to end up fighting Shaun Chan, and most likely Trollocs as well. And he would be there when it happened. There was no getting around the fact. Try to avoid it how he would, that bloody Taviran twisting would put him right in the bloody middle. So he was ready to pour out gold like water if it gave him a way to kill his enemies before they got close enough to poke holes in his hide. Aludra tilted her head to one side, pursing her rosebud lips.
Who is this man with such power?
It'll have to be a secret between us. Tom and Julin know, and Aginan and Doman and the Aes Sedai, Teslin and Jolene at least, and Vannon and the Red Arms, but nobody else. And I want to keep it that way.
Blood and bloody ashes, far too many people knew already. He waited for her curt nod before saying, The Dragon Reborn.
The colors swirled, and despite his fighting them again, became Rand and Loyal for a moment. This was not going to be as easy as it had seemed.
You know the Dragon Reborn, she said doubtfully.
We grew up in the same village, he growled, already fighting the colors. This time they nearly coalesced before vanishing. If you don't believe me, ask Teslin and Jolene. Ask Tom. But don't do it around anyone else. A secret, remember?
The guild has been my life since I was a girl.
She scraped one of the sticks quickly down the side of the box, and the thing sputtered into flame. It smelled of sulfur.
The dragons, they are my life now. The dragons and revenge on the Shaun Chan.
Bending, she touched the flame to a dark length of fuse that ran under the canvas. As soon as the fuse caught, she shook the stick until the fire went out, then dropped it. With a crackling hiss, the flame sped along the fuse.
I think me, I believe you.
She held out her free hand.
When you leave, I will go with you. And you will help me make my dragons.
For a moment, as he shook her hand, he was sure the dice had stopped. But a heartbeat later, they were rattling again. It must have been imagination. After all, this agreement with Aludra might help the band, and incidentally Matt Cawthon stay alive, yet it could hardly be called fateful. He would still have to fight those battles, and however you planned, however well-trained your men were, luck played its part too, bad as well as good even for him. These dragons would not change that. But were the dice bouncing as loudly? He thought not. Yet how could he be sure? Never before had they slowed without stopping. It had to be his imagination. A hollow thump came from inside the enclosure, and acrid smoke billowed over the canvas wall. Moments later, the nightflower bloomed in the darkness above Runian Crossing, a great ball of red and green streaks. It bloomed again and again in his dreams that night, and for many nights after. But there it bloomed among charging horsemen and massed pikes, rending flesh as he had once seen stone rent by fireworks. In his dreams, he tried to catch the things with his hands, tried to stop them, yet they rained down in unending streams on 100 battlefields. In his dreams, he wept for the death and destruction. And somehow it seemed that the rattling of the dice in his head sounded like laughter. Not his laughter, the Dark One's laughter. The next morning, with the sun just rising toward a cloudless sky, he was sitting on the steps of his green wagon, carefully scraping at the bowstave with a sharp knife. You had to be careful, almost delicate. A careless slice could ruin all your work. When Aginan and Doman came out. Strangely, they seemed to have dressed with special care, in their best, such as it was. He was not the only one to have bought cloth in Jurador. but without promises of Matt's gold to speed them, the seamstresses were still sewing for Doman and Aginan. The blue-eyed Shan Chen woman wore a bright green dress heavily embroidered, with tiny white and yellow flowers on the high neck and all down the sleeves. A flowered scarf held her long black wig in place. Doman, looking decidedly odd with a head of very short hair and that Ilioner beard that left his upper lip bare, had brushed his worn brown coat till it actually had some semblance of neatness. They squeezed past Matt and hurried off without a word, and he thought no more of it until they returned an hour or so later to announce that they had been into the village and gotten Mother Darvale to marry them. He could not stop himself from gaping. Aginan's stern face and sharp eyes gave good indications of her character. What could have brought Doman to marry the woman? As soon marry a bear. Realizing the Ilioner was beginning to glare at him, he hastily got to his feet and made a presentable bow over the bowstave. "Congratulations, Master Doman. Congratulations, Mistress Doman. The light shone on you both." What else was he to say? Doman kept glaring at him as if he had heard Matt's thoughts, though, and Aginan snorted.
"My name is Lyowin Shipless, Cawthon," she drawled. "That's the name I was given, and the name I'll die with. And a good name it is, since it helped me reach a decision I should have made weeks ago."
Frowning, she looked sideways at Doman.
"You do understand why I could not take your name, don't you, Bale?"
"No, lass,"
Doman replied gently, resting a thick hand on her shoulder.
"But I will take you with any name you do care to use, so long as you do be my wife. I told you that."
She smiled and laid her hand atop his, and he began smiling too. Light, but the pair of them were sickening. If marriage made a man start smiling like dreamy syrup, well, not Matt Cawthon. He might be as good as wed, but Matt Cawthon was never going to start carrying on like a loon. And that was how he ended up in a green-striped wall tent, not very large, that belonged to a pair of lean Domani brothers who ate fire and swallowed swords. Even Tom admitted that Ballet and Abar were good, and they were popular with the other performers, so finding them places to stay was easy, but that tent cost as much as the wagon had. Everybody knew he had gold to fling about, and that pair just sighed over giving up their snug home when he tried to bargain them down. Well, a new bride and groom needed privacy, and he was more than glad to give it to them, if it meant he did not have to watch them go moon-eyed at each other. Besides, he was tired of taking his turn sleeping on the floor. In the tent, at least, he had his own cot every night. Narrow and hard it might be, yet it was softer than floorboards. And with only him, he had more room than in the wagon, even after the rest of his clothes were moved in, and stowed in a pair of brass-bound chests. He had a washstand of his very own, a ladder-backed chair that was not too unsteady, a sturdy stool, and a table big enough to hold a plate and cup and a pair of decent brass lamps. The chest of gold he left in the green wagon. Only a blind fool would try robbing Doman. Only a madman would try robbing Aginan. Lyowin, if she insisted, though he was still certain she would regain her senses eventually. After the first night, spent close by the Aes Sedai wagon with the fox head cool for half the night, he had the tent set up facing Tuon's wagon by dint of making sure that the Red Arms started raising it before anyone else could claim the space.
"Are you placing yourself as my guard now?"
Tuon said coolly when she saw the tent for the first time.
"No," he replied. "I'm just hoping for more glimpses of you." That was the light's own truth.
Well, getting away from the Aes Sedai was part of it, but the other was true, too. Yet the woman waggled her fingers at Seleucia, and the pair of them launched into gales of giggles before recovering themselves and re-entering the faded purple wagon with all the dignity of a royal procession. Women. He was not often alone in the tent. He had taken on Lopin as his body servant after Nalisian's death, and the stout tyrant with his blocky face and a beard that nearly reached his chest was always popping in to bow his balding head and ask what Milord would enjoy for his next meal, or inquire whether Milord had any need of wine or tea, or would care for a plate of candied dried figs he had vaguely acquired somewhere. Lopin was vain over his ability to find delicacies where it seemed there could be none. That, or he was rifling through the clothes chests to see whether anything needed repair or cleaning or ironing. something always did in his estimation, though it all looked fine to Matt. Nerim, Talmanis's melancholy body-servant, frequently accompanied him, largely because the skinny gray-haired Kyrianen was bored. Matt could not understand how anyone could get bored with not having any work to do, but Nerim was full of dolorous comments on how poorly Talmanis must be faring without him, mournfully sighing about 5 times a day that Talmanis must have given his place to another by now, and he was ready to wrestle Lopin, if need be, for a share of the cleaning and mending. He even wanted his turn blacking Matt's boots. Noel dropped by to spin his tall tails and Alver to play stones or snakes and foxes when he was not playing with Tuon instead. Tom came to play stones, too, and to share rumors he picked up in the towns and villages, knuckling his long white mustaches over the choicer bits. Julin brought his own reports, but he always brought Amathera as well. The former Panarch of Terabun was pretty enough for Matt to understand why the thief-catcher was interested, with a rosebud mouth just made for kissing, and she clung to Julin's arm as if she might return some of his feelings, but her big eyes always gazed fearfully toward Tuon's wagon, even when they were all inside Matt's tent. And it was still all Julin could do to keep her from dropping to her knees and putting her face to the ground whenever she glimpsed Tuon or Seleucia. She did the same with Aginan, and with Bethamin and Sita besides. Considering that Amathera had been Dacovale for just a matter of months, it fair made Matt's skin crawl. Tuon could not really mean to make him Dacovale when she was going to marry him, could she? He soon told them to stop bringing him rumors about Rand. Fighting the colors in his head was too much effort, and he lost that fight as often as he won. Sometimes it was all right, but sometimes he caught glimpses of Rand and Min, and it seemed those two were carrying on something awful. Anyway, the rumors were all the same, really. The dragon reborn was dead, killed by Aes Sedai, by Ashaman, by the Seanchan, by 12 assassins. No, he was in hiding. He was massing a secret army. He was doing some fool thing or other that varied village by village and usually inn by inn. The one thing that was clear was that Rand was no longer in Kyrian, and nobody had any idea where he was. The dragon reborn had vanished. It was odd how many of these Altaran farmers and villagers and townsfolk seemed worried by that, as worried as the merchants passing through and the men and women who worked for them. Not one of those people knew any more of the dragon reborn than the tales they carried, yet his disappearance frightened them. Tom and Julin were clear on that until he made them stop. If the dragon reborn was dead, what was the world to do? That was the question that people asked over breakfast in the morning and ale in the evening and likely on going to bed. Matt could have told them Rand was alive. Those bloody visions made him sure of that. But explaining how he knew was another matter. Even Tom and Julin seemed uncertain about the colors. The merchants and the others would have thought him a madman, and if they believed, that would only scatter rumors about him, not to mention likely setting the Seanchan to hunting for him. All he wanted was the bloody colors out of his head. Moving into the tent made the show folk eye him very oddly, and small wonder. First, he had been running off with Aginan, Lyowin, if she insisted on it, and Doman supposedly was her servant. But now she was married to Doman, and Matt was out of the wagon entirely. Some of the show folks seemed to think it no more than he deserved for trailing after Tuon, yet a surprising number offered him sympathy. Several men commiserated over the fickleness of women, at least they did when there were no women around, and some of the unmarried women, contortionists and acrobats and seamstresses, began eyeing him much too warmly. He might have enjoyed that if they had not been so willing to give him smoky looks right in front of Tuon. The first time that happened, he was so startled that his eyes nearly popped. Tuon seemed to find it amusing, of all things. She seemed to. But only a fool thought he knew what was in a woman's head just because she had a smile on her face. He continued to dine with her every midday, halted, and began arriving at his nightly games of stones early, so she had to feed him then, too. Light's truth, if you got a woman to feed you on a regular basis, she was halfway won. At least he dined with her when she would let him into the wagon. One night he found the latch down, and no amount of talking would make her or Seleucia open the door. It seemed a bird had managed to get inside during the day, an extremely bad omen, apparently, and the pair of them had to spend the night in prayer and contemplation to avert some evil or other. They seem to run half their lives according to strange superstitions. Tuon or Seleucia, either one, would make odd signs with their hands if they saw a torn spider web with the spider in it. And Tuon explained to him, just as serious as if she were making sense, that the sure result of clearing away a spider web before shooing the spider out of it was the death of someone close to you within the month. They would see a flight of birds circle more than once and predict a storm, or draw a finger through a line of marching ants, count how long it took for the ants to rejoin their line, and predict how many days of fair weather lay ahead, and never mind that it did not work out that way. Oh, there was rain 3 days after the birds, crows, disturbingly enough, but it was nowhere near a storm, just a gray, drizzling day.
"Obviously Seleucia miscounted with the ants," Tuon said, placing a white stone on the board with that oddly graceful arching of her fingers.
Seleucia, watching over her shoulder in a white blouse and divided brown skirts, nodded. As usual, she wore a headscarf over her short golden hair, even indoors, a length of red and gold silk that day. Tuon was all in brocaded blue silk, a coat of odd cut that covered her hips, and divided skirts so narrow they seemed to be wide trousers. She spent considerable time giving the seamstresses detailed instructions on what she wanted sewn, and little of it was much like anything he'd ever seen before. It was all in Shawn Chan styles, he suspected, though she had had a few riding dresses sewn that would not draw comment for when she went outside. Rain pattered softly on the roof of the wagon.
"Obviously, what the birds told us was modified by the ants.
It is never simple, Toy. You must learn these things. I will not have you ignorant."
Matt nodded as if that made sense and placed his black stone. And she called his uneasiness about crows and ravens superstition. Knowing when to keep your mouth shut was a useful skill around women. Around men, too, but more so around women. You could be pretty certain what would set a man's eyes on fire. Talking with her could be dangerous in other ways, too.
"What do you know of the dragon reborn?" she asked him another evening.
He choked on a mouthful of wine, and the whirling colors in his brain dissipated in a fit of coughing. The wine was near enough vinegar, but even Naram had a hard time finding good wine these days.
"Well, he's the dragon reborn," he said, when he could speak, wiping wine from his chin with one hand.
For a moment he saw Rand eating at a large dark table.
"What else is there to know?"
Seleucia refilled his cup smoothly.
"A great deal, Toy. For one thing, he must kneel to the crystal throne before Tarmangaiden. The prophecies are clear on that. But I haven't even been able to learn where he is. It becomes still more urgent if he is the one who sounded the Horn of Valyr, as I suspect."
"The Horn of Valyr?" he said weakly. "The prophecy said what?"
"It's been found, then?"
"It must have been, mustn't it, if it was sounded," she drawled dryly. "The reports I've seen from the place where it was blown, a place called Falma, are very disturbing. Very disturbing. Securing whoever blew the horn, man or woman, may be as important as securing the dragon reborn himself. Are you going to play a stone or not, Toy?"
He played his stone, but he was so shaken that the colors whirled and faded without forming any image. In fact, he was barely able to eke out a draw from what had seemed a clear winning position.
"You played very poorly toward the end," Tuon murmured, frowning thoughtfully at the board, now divided evenly between the control of black stones and white.
He could all but see her start trying to work out what they had been talking about when his poor play began. Talking with her was like walking a crumbling ledge across the face of a cliff. One misstep and Matt Cawthon would be as dead as last year's mutton. Only he had to walk that ledge. He had no bloody choice. Oh, he enjoyed it, in a way. The longer he spent with her, the more opportunity to memorize that heart-shaped face, to get it down so he could see her just by closing his eyes. But there was always that misstep waiting ahead. He could almost see that, too. For several days after giving her the little bunch of silk flowers, he brought her no presents, and he thought he was beginning to detect hints of disappointment when he appeared empty-handed. Then, 4 days out of Jurador, just as the sun was peeking over the horizon into a nearly cloudless sky, he got her and Seleucia out of the purple wagon. Well, he just wanted two on, but Seleucia might as well have been her shadow when it came to trying to separate them. He had commented on that once, making a joke, and both women went on talking as if he had not spoken. It was a good thing he knew Tuan could laugh at a joke, because sometimes she seemed to have no sense of humor at all. Seleucia, wrapped in a green wool cloak, with the cowl all but hiding her red headscarf, eyed him suspiciously, but then she nearly always did. Tuan never bothered with a scarf, yet the shortness of her black hair was not so apparent with the hood of her blue cloak up. "Cover your eyes, precious," he said. "I have a surprise for you."
"I like surprises," she replied, placing her hands over her big eyes. For an instant she smiled in anticipation, but only for an instant. "Some surprises, Toy." That had the sound of a warning.
Seleucia stood hard by her shoulder, and though the bosomy woman appeared completely at her ease, something told him she was as tense as a cat ready to leap. He suspected she did not like surprises. "Wait right there," he said, and ducked around the side of the purple wagon. When he returned, he was leading Pips and the Razor, both saddled and bridled. The mare stepped lively, frisking at the prospect of an outing. "You can look now. I thought you might like a ride."
They had hours. The show might as well have been deserted for all the evidence of life among the wagons. Only a handful had smoke rising from their metal chimneys.
"She's yours," he added, and stiffened as the words nearly froze in his throat. There was no doubt this time. He had said the horse was hers, and suddenly the dice were not beating so loudly in his head. It was not that they had slowed, he was sure of that. There had been more than one set rattling away. One had stopped when he made his agreement with Aludra, and another when he told Tuan the horse was hers. That was odd in itself. How could giving her a horse be fateful for him? But light it had been bad enough when he had to worry about one set of dice giving warning at a time. How many sets were still bouncing off the inside of his skull? How many more fateful moments were waiting to crash down on him? Tuan went immediately to the Razor, all smiles as she examined the animal as thoroughly as he had himself. She did train horses for fun, after all. Horses and Damani, the light help him. Seleucia was studying him, he realized, her expression an expressionless mask. Because of the horse, or because he had gone stiff as a post? "She's a Razor," he said, patting Pips's blunt nose. The gelding had been getting plenty of exercise, but the Razor's eagerness seemed to have infected him. "Damani Bloodborne favor Razors, and it's not likely you'll ever see one outside of Ered Daman. What will you name her?"
"It is bad luck to name a horse before riding it," Tuan replied, taking the reins. She was still beaming. Her big eyes shone. "She's a very fine animal, Toy. A wonderful gift. Either you have a good eye, or you were very lucky."
"I have a good eye, precious," he said warily. She seemed more delighted than even the Razor called for.
"If you say so. Where is Seleucia's mount?"
Oh, well, it had been worth a try. A smart man hedged his bets, though, so a sharp whistle brought Metwin at a trot leading a saddled Dapple. Matt ignored the wide grin that split the man's pale face. The Kyrian and Redarm had been sure he would not get away with leaving Seleucia behind, but there was no need to smirk over it. Matt judged the Dapple gelding, 10 years old, to be gentle enough for Seleucia. In his memory, ladies' maids seldom were more than tolerable riders, but the woman gave the animal a going-over as complete as Tuan's. And when she was done, she directed a look at Matt that said she would ride the horse so as not to make a bother, but she found it decidedly lacking. Women could compress a great deal into one look. Once clear of the field where the show was camped, Tuan walked the Razor along the road for a time, then took her to a trot, and then a canter. The surface was hard-packed yellow clay here, studded with edges of old paving stones. No trouble for a well-shod horse, though, and he had made sure of the Razor's shoes. Matt kept Pips even with Tuan, as much for the pleasure of watching her smile as anything else. When Tuan was enjoying herself, the stern judge was forgotten, and pure delight shone on her face. Not that watching her was easy, since Seleucia had the Dapple between them.
The yellow-haired woman was a formidable chaperone, and by the sidelong glances she gave him, her small smiles, she very much enjoyed the job of frustrating him. At the start, they had the road to themselves, except for a few farm carts, but after a while a tinker caravan appeared ahead of them, a line of garishly painted and lacquered wagons rolling slowly southward down the other side of the road with massive dogs trotting alongside. Those dogs were the only real protection tinkers had. The driver of the lead wagon, a thing as red as Luca's coats, trimmed in yellow and with violent green and yellow wheels to boot, half stood to peer toward Matt, then sat back down and said something to the woman beside him, doubtless reassured by the presence of the two women with Matt. Tinkers were a cautious lot, of necessity. That whole caravan would whip up their horses and flee a single man they thought meant harm. Matt nodded to the fellow as the wagons began to pass. The lean, gray-haired man's high-collared coat was as green as his wagon's wheels, and his wife's dress was striped in shades of blue, most bright enough to suit any of the show's performers. The gray-haired man raised his hand in a wave. And Tuon suddenly turned the razor and galloped into the trees, cloak streaming out behind her. In a flash, Seleucia had the Dapple darting after her. Snatching his hat off so as not to lose it, Matt wheeled Pips and followed. Shouts rose from the wagons, but he paid them no mind. His attention was all on Tuon. He wished he knew what she was up to. Not escape, he was sure. Likely she was just trying to make him tear out his hair. If so, she was in a fair way for succeeding. Pips quickly reeled in the Dapple and left a scowling Seleucia behind, flailing her mount with the reins, but Tuon and the Razor kept their lead as the rolling land climbed toward hills. Startled flights of birds sprang up from beneath both animals' hooves, coveys of gray dove and of brown-speckled quail, sometimes ruffed brown grouse. All disaster needed was for the mare to be frightened by one of those. The best-trained mount could rear and fall when a bird burst up under hoof. Worse, Tuon rode like a madwoman, never slowing, only swerving from her line, where the underbrush lay dense, leaping trees toppled by old storms as if she had a clue what lay on the other side. Well, he had to ride like a madman himself to keep up, though he winced every time he set Pips to jump a tree trunk. Some were near as thick as he was tall. He dug his boot heels into the gelding's flanks, urging more speed, though he knew Pips was running as hard as he ever had. He had chosen too well in that bloody razor. Up and up they raced through the forest. As abruptly as she had begun her mad dash, Tuon reined in, well over a mile from the road. The trees were old here and widely spaced, black pines 40 paces tall and wide-spreading oaks with branches that arched down to touch the ground before rising again, and could have been sliced crosswise into tables to seat a dozen in comfort. Thick creepers shrouded half-buried boulders and stone outcrops, but aside from that, only a few weeds pushed through the mulch. Oaks that size killed off any lesser undergrowth beneath them. "Your animal is better than he looks," the fool woman said, patting her mount's neck when he reached her. Oh, she was all innocence, just out for a pleasant ride. "Maybe you do have a good eye." With the cowl of her cloak fallen down her back, her cap of short hair was visible, glistening like black silk. He suppressed a desire to stroke it. "Burn how good my eye is," he growled, clapping his hat on. He knew he should speak smoothly, but he could not have taken the roughness from his voice with a file. "Do you always ride like a moon-blinded idiot? You could have broken that mare's neck before she even got a name. Worse, you could have broken your own. I promised to get you home safely, and I mean to do just that. If you're going to risk killing yourself every time you go riding, then I won't let you ride." He wished he had those last words back as soon as they left his tongue. A man might laugh off a threat like that as a joke, maybe, if he were lucky. But a woman? Now all he could do was wait for the explosion. He expected Aludra's nightflowers to pale by comparison. She raised the hood of her cloak, settling it just so. She studied him, tilting her head first one way, then the other. Finally, she nodded to herself.
"I name her Achaean. That means swallow."
Matt blinked. That was it? No eruption? "I know. A good name. It suits her." What was she about now? The woman almost never did or said what he expected.
"What is this place, Toy?" she said, frowning at the trees. Or should I say, what was it? Do you know?
What did she mean? What was this place? It was a bloody forest, was what it was. But suddenly, what had seemed a large boulder right in front of him, nearly obscured by thick vines, resolved into a huge stone head, slightly tilted to one side. A woman's head, he thought. Those smooth rondelles were probably meant for jewels in her hair. The statue it sat on must have been immense. A full span of the thing showed, yet only her eyes and the top of her head were out of the ground. And that long white stone outcrop with an oak tree's roots growing over it was a piece of a spiral column. All around them now he could make out bits of columns and large worked stones that plainly had been part of some grand structure, and what had to be a stone sword 2 spans long, all half-buried. Still, ruins of cities and monuments could be found in many places, and few even among Aes Sedai had any idea what they had been. Opening his mouth to say that he did not know, he caught sight through the trees of 3 tall hills in a row, perhaps another mile on. The middle hill had a cleft top, like a wedge cut cleanly out, while the hill on the left had 2. And he knew. There could hardly be 3 hills exactly like that anywhere else. Those hills had been called the Dancers when this place had been Londaran Kor, the capital city of Aharon. The road behind them had been paved then and ran through the heart of the city, which had sprawled for miles. People had said that the artistry in stone that the Ogier had practiced in Tarvalen they had perfected in Londaran Kor. Of course, the people of every Ogier-built city had claimed their own outdid Tarvalen, confirming Tarvalen as the touchstone. He had a number of memories of the city, dancing at a ball in the Palace of the Moon, carousing in soldiers' taverns, where veiled dancers writhed, watching the procession of flutes during the blessing of the swords. But oddly, he had another memory of those hills, from near enough 500 years after the Trollocs left no stone standing in Londaran Kor, and Aharon died in blood and fire. Why it had been necessary for Nerevan and Isandara to invade Shiota, as the land was then, he did not know. Those old memories were fragments however long a time anyone covered, and full of gaps. He had no idea why those hills had been called the Dancers, either, or what the Blessing of the Swords was. But he remembered being an Essendarin lord in a battle fought among these ruins, and he remembered having those hills in view when he took an arrow through his throat. He must have fallen no more than 0.5 mile from the very spot where he sat Pips, drowning in his own blood. Light, I hate to remember dying, he thought, and the thought turned to a coal burning in his brain, a coal that burned hotter and hotter. He remembered those men's deaths, not just one, but dozens of them. He remembered dying.
Toy, are you ill?
Tuan brought the mare close and peered up into his face. Concern filled her big eyes.
You've gone pale as the moon.
I'm right as spring water, he muttered. She was close enough for him to kiss if he bent his head, but he did not move. He could not. He was thinking so furiously he had nothing left for motion. Somehow, only the light knew, the eel fin, had gathered the memories they had planted in his head. How could they harvest memory from a corpse? A corpse in the world of men, at that. He was certain they never came to this side of that twisted door-framed Tirangriol for longer than minutes at a time. A way occurred to him, one he did not like, not a scrap. Maybe they created some sort of link to any human who visited them, a link that allowed them to copy all of a man's memories after that, right up to the moment he died. In some of those memories from other men, he was white-haired. In some, only a few years older than he really was. And everything in between. But there were none of childhood or growing up. What were the odds of that, if they had just stuffed him with random bits and pieces, likely things they considered rubbish or had done with? What did they do with memories, anyway? They had to have some reason for gathering them beyond giving them away again. No, he was just trying to avoid where this led. Burn him. The bloody foxes were inside his head right then. They had to be. It was the only explanation that made sense.
Well, you look as if you're about to vomit, Tuan said, backing the razor away with a grimace. Who in the show would have herbs? I have some knowledge there.
I'm all right, I tell you.
In truth, he did want to sick up. Having those foxes in his head was 1,000 times worse than the dice, however hard the dice rattled. Could the eel fin see through his eyes? Light, what was he going to do? He doubted any Aes Sedai could heal him of this, not that he would trust them to, not when it meant leaving off the fox head. There was nothing to be done. He would just have to live with it. He groaned at the thought.
Cantering up to them, Seleucia gave him and Tuon each a quick look, as if considering what they might have been up to in their time alone. But then she had taken her time in catching up, giving them that time. That was hopeful.
"Next time you can ride this gentle creature, and I will ride your gelding," she told Matt. "Hi, lady. People from those wagons are following us with dogs. They're afoot, but they will be here soon. The dogs don't bark."
"Trained guard dogs, then," Tuon said, gathering her reins. "Mounted, we can avoid them easily enough."
"No need to try and no use," Matt told her. He should have expected this. "Those people are tinkers, Tuatha'an, and they're no danger to anybody. They couldn't be violent if their lives depended on it. That's no exaggeration, just simple truth. But they saw you two go herring off trying to get away from me, as it must have seemed, and me chasing after. Now that those dogs have a scent trail, the tinkers will follow us all the way back to the show if need be to make sure you two haven't been kidnapped or harmed. We'll go meet them to save the time and trouble."
It was not the tinkers' time he cared about.
Luca probably would not care one way or the other if a bunch of tinkers getting in the way delayed the show setting out, but Matt certainly would. Seleucia scowled at him indignantly, and her fingers flew, but Tuon laughed.
"Toy wishes to be commanding today, Seleucia. I will let him command and see how he does."
Bloody kind of her. They trotted back the way they had come, riding around the fallen trees this time, though now and then Tuon would gather her reins as if she meant to jump one, then give Matt a mischievous grin. And it was not long before the tinkers came into sight, running through the trees behind their huge mastiffs, like a flight of butterflies. 50 or so men and women in bright colors, often in jarring combinations. A man might be wearing a red and blue striped coat and baggy yellow trousers tucked into knee boots, or a violet-colored coat above red trousers, or worse. Some women wore dresses striped in as many colors as there were colors, and even colors Matt had no name for, while others wore skirts and blouses as varied in hue and as clashing as the men's coats and trousers. A fair number had shawls as well, to add more colors to the eye-scrambling blend. Except for the gray-haired man who had been driving the lead wagon, they all appeared to be short of their middle years. He must be the seeker, the leader of the caravan. Matt dismounted, and after a moment Tuon and Seleucia did too. The tinkers stopped at that, calling their dogs to heel. The big animals slumped to the ground, tongues lolling out, and the people came on more slowly. None carried so much as a stick, and though Matt wore no weapons that showed, they eyed him warily. The men clustered in front of him, while the women gathered around Tuon and Seleucia. There was no threat in it, but as easily as that, Tuon and Seleucia were separated from him, off where the tinker women could make inquiries. Suddenly it occurred to him that Tuon might think it a fine game to claim he was trying to bother her. She and Seleucia could ride off while he was trying to contend with tinkers crowding around him and Pips, so he could not climb into the saddle. That was all they would do, but unless he was willing to fight his way clear, they might keep him here for hours, maybe, to give that pair time to escape.
The gray-haired man bowed with his hands pressed to his chest. "Peace be on you and yours, my lord. Forgiveness if we intrude, but we feared our dogs had frightened the lady's horses."
Matt responded with a bow in the same fashion.
"Peace be on you always, seeker, and on all the people. The lady's horses weren't frightened. The ladies are impetuous at times."
What were the women saying? He tried to eavesdrop, but their voices were low murmurs.
"You know something of the people, my lord?"
The seeker sounded surprised and had a right to. The Tuatha'an kept away from anywhere larger than a moderate-sized village. They would seldom encounter anyone in a silk coat.
Only a little, Matt replied. A very little. He had memories of meeting tinkers, but he himself had never spoken to one before. What were those bloody women saying? Will you answer me a question? I've seen a number of your caravans the past few days, more than I'd have expected to, and all heading toward Abu Dhar. Is there a reason? The man hesitated, darting a glance toward the women. They were still murmuring away, and he had to be wondering why their conversation was lasting so long. After all, it only needed a moment to say, yes, I need help, or the opposite.
It is the people called Shonchan, my lord, he said finally. Word is spreading among the people that there is safety where the Shonchan rule, and equal justice for all. Elsewhere, you understand, my lord.
Matt did. Like the Shofolk, tinkers were strangers wherever they went, and worse, strangers with an undeserved reputation for thievery. Well, they stole no more often than anyone else. And a deserved one for trying to entice young people into joining them. And on top of it, for tinkers, there was no question of fighting back if anybody tried to rob them or chase them away.
Take care, Seeker. Their safety comes at a price, and some of their laws are harsh. You know what they do with women who can channel?
Thank you for your concern, my lord, the man said calmly. But few of our women ever begin channeling, and if one does, we will do as we always do, and take her to Tarvalen.
Abruptly, the women began laughing. Great gales and peals. The Seeker relaxed visibly. If the women were laughing, Matt was not the kind of man who would strike them down or kill them for getting in his way. For Matt's part, he scowled. There was nothing in that laughter that he liked. The tinkers made their departure with more apologies from the Seeker for having bothered them, but the women kept looking back and laughing behind cupped hands. Some of the men leaned close as they walked, plainly asking questions, but the women just shook their heads and looked back again, laughing.
"What did you tell them?" Matt asked sourly.
"Oh, that's none of your business now, is it, Toy?" Tuan replied, and Salusha laughed.
Oh, she bloody cackled, she did.
He decided he was better off not knowing. Women just purely enjoyed planting needles in a man.